Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
The life and work of Martin Luther in Radio Biography with Pastor Jamie Krieger.
Thank you for listening to Lutheran Radio UK. I am Jamie Krieger, and I am the Associate Pastor at Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent, a southeastern suburb of the Greater London. At Christ Church, we hold services every Sunday morning at 10:30. Pastor John Ehlers and I are also co-vacancy pastors of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Harlow, Essex, where the services take place on Sundays at 11 a.m. For Bible study times, as well as other activities and missions sponsored by these congregations, go to lutheran.co.uk and find us under directory. I am also Lutheran Radio UK's manager and would love to hear your opinions on our entire range of programs. So send me an email on manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. We're back with Radio Biography, and our series continues on the life and work of the 16th century German theologian Dr. Martin Luther, a man with a profound theological insight that has shaped to a great extent the world we live in today. And our guest is back with us, Dr. Robert Rosin from Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, Missouri. Welcome back, Dr. Rosin. Last week you spoke to us about Luther's understanding of the relationship between church and state and how grossly misread he was by the German National Socialist Party. Following up from where we stopped, why is Luther said to have become increasingly anti-Semitic towards the end of his life? Or is this also a misreading?
The use that the National Socialists made of Luther obviously is tied to this allegation of anti-Semitism. Luther is known for some rather virulent and violent things that he said at the end of his life. But we really have to back up and look at Luther again in a larger context, in the larger flow of things. In the 1520s, Luther wrote a thing called The Jesus Christ Was Born of a Jew. Titles are sometimes sort of funny and cumbersome in Luther's day and age. What Luther was saying in this tract was that we should really thank the Jews and honor them for having preserved the promise of the Messiah for all these years, and we should be particularly careful for them and watch out for them in our present-day society, he said to his 16th-century Germans, because these are the people who, in effect, kind of sheltered and cradled the promise and then Christ who grew out of them. Then the question is, of course, why don't they accept Christ? Luther said judging from the confusion in the theology of his day, he said it's a wonder that anybody believed in Christianity and understood Christ with the mixed faith plus works message that you've got. So given that, it wasn't surprising at all that the Jews would say, no, we're waiting for a real Messiah. Luther's point, well, the real Messiah, in fact, is here if you read the scriptures correctly. If you really see Christ and his grace alone, which when grasped by faith alone saves, then you realize that the promise is fulfilled. So he expected that once the gospel came clear in the Reformation, there would be these conversions from people from the outside who formerly resisted, including, of course, the Jews. It didn't happen. Now, Luther probably, I suspect that the number of Jews that Luther actually met in his lifetime, you could probably count on two hands, maybe even one. They simply didn't live in that territory. Many territories simply didn't allow them. It seems odd to say that in these days. There were parts of Europe where Jews tended to flock and congregate, where they were welcome because of their skills, their trade connections, and so forth, and they posed no particular social threat. Their religious views were simply kind of overlooked. In Luther's part of Germany, however, the Jews had long ago been ushered out of electoral Saxony. There is, ironically, a so-called Judenviertel, a Jewish quarter in Wittenberg. It's there by name only. There were no Jews living there at all. So he doesn't really know them, but he expects that once they hear of the Reformation and see the gospel, the change will come about. In the 1530s, however, there was a delegation that came, received permission to come travel to Wittenberg and to talk with Luther, and they said to him, basically, to put it in modern slang, knock it off. We're tired of you finding Christ in the Old Testament. These are our scriptures. You don't understand them, and you're simply wrong. At which point, Luther really blew a gasket and said, we've done everything we can. We've put the gospel out there on a silver platter here in front of them, plain as day, and yet they come and reject Christ. From that point, Luther's attitude toward them soured greatly.
And how do we know this?
We have in Luther's late life, just a couple of years before his death, this treatise that he wrote against the Jews and their lies, in which he says some really violent and horrible things. He advocates gathering up of their own sacred writings. They should be burned. Their synagogues should be torn down to the ground. And people look at this and say, how could Luther be so anti-Semitic? He's not being anti-Semitic. It's not a racial thing. He's really upset by their refusal to accept the gospel, which in his mind is plain as day right in front of them, as plain as the nose on their faces. And so why in the world don't they really, really believe this? And so he really kind of goes overboard. You have to also remember that Luther was expecting that the world might end at any time. This is very common in his day and age, this kind of expectation of imminent eschatology, as we say. That is to say, the second coming of Christ at any moment. And he's worried that the Jews, who for so long suffered so much for the sake of the promise of the Messiah, now at the last minute, in the 11th hour, would suddenly say no, and then Christ would come, and they'd be lost. And how horrible would that be? And so certainly it's not the kind of evangelism method any of us would sanction today, but Luther almost wishes to kind of force them, kind of stampede them into accepting of Christ. He's a man who lives very much with a vision of the second coming right around the corner.
Speaking of Luther's apocalyptic expectations, the Ottoman threat was a big issue in his day. How did he see it? And also, how does the reading of Luther help us or hinder us in our conversations with Muslims today?
Well, even as Luther had little personal contact with Jews, he probably had even less contact with Muslims, for certain. They were not living in Europe. What they were doing actually was threatening Europe. Really, the Ottomans coming up from the Bosporus, from Constantinople, they conquered the city, Constantinople, in 1453, and then began to move up the Danube Valley through Austrian lands, Hungarian lands. They made it as far as Vienna in 1529, laid siege to the city, but then had to move back down the Danube for various reasons. And the Holy Roman Empire, as it was called, that is to say the German lands, were spared at the time. They, of course, don't know that the Ottomans are not going to come back. They expect any moment that will come that far. Should Vienna fall, then what's next? I mean, there's nothing of any substantial size in the Vienna Valley, in the Danube Valley, then between Vienna and when you actually hit the German territories. So they're much worried about this. Luther looked upon the Ottomans as a kind of warning from God, really, to get their house in order. This was a way of God chastising people, warning people. At the same time, it must be said that on a different level, it was actually a benefit to the Reformation. The Emperor Charles V was elected at a very young age. His grandfather, Maximilian I, had died in 1519, and then Charles is elected. Charles comes from a Habsburg family. They controlled Spain, Burgundy, the Low Countries, Netherlands, and Belgium today, and also, through family connections, also the Austrian territory and lands to the east. A huge personal empire already. Give him then the German lands in the middle, and he becomes a very powerful person. But he also has enemies as well. On the one side, he has Francis I and France, who were constantly sniping and at war with the Spanish. That's a war to the west. And to the east, Charles has the Turk to worry about, the Ottoman Empire, the Turk, as they commonly said. And he leaves his leaves that part of the defense to his brother, but it's still a worry for him. In other words, he's distracted with a kind of two-front war, as it were. He does not like the Reformation. He's not a fan of Luther at all. He wants it to cease and desist, but he can't really spend any energy on it because should he lose to France or should he lose to the Ottomans, he's not going to have an empire anyway to worry about. So if you put yourself in Charles's shoes, you understand how he would sort of pick his battles or pick his wars in a certain order. So Luther could see the Ottoman Turk coming as a kind of a blessing on a second level to the Reformation because it gave them some breathing room, some space in which to operate to get the message out. In terms of the Muslims personally, Luther doesn't have a terrible amount to say about them, though he is, interestingly enough, supportive of the idea that they actually do wind up worshiping or praying to God. We sometimes think, well, they call God Allah. That's simply the Arabic name for God. And Luther saw them as having a kind of worship of God, but of a warped God, or that is to say, a kind of a misunderstood God. That's probably a better term. They certainly didn't understand the Trinity properly, he thought, and they don't understand God in his grace and in his mercy. But they do indeed acknowledge God, God's existence. They do understand their sinfulness over against God, though the nature and the depths of sin would be even heightened through the Christian message in contrast to the gospel, law versus the gospel. They're kind of on the right track, so to speak. What they need is some encouragement. They need more discussion. They need to further dialogue to see how, in fact, they might somehow square with Christianity. Today, we carry on dialogue because Muslims are living right in our midst. That didn't happen in Luther's day. But there at least is this attitude, I think, generally speaking, that one can get from Luther, that it's worth talking to them about. He didn't feel particularly threatened theologically, because he thought, of course, we understand law and gospel, we understand Trinity, the nature of Christ as God, and so we can, on that ground, bear witness to other people. He's not threatened by the presence of others. They're simply people there to be talked with, to have conversation with.
Is there any recent Lutheran publication on the conversations between Lutherans and Muslims?
There is a book out from Concordia Publishing House called Muslim Friends by the author Roland Miller, who spent many years in Muslim missions. He really kind of strikes up this same approach or this same tone to say, you know, there are many places in which Christianity and Islam can find some common ground to begin conversations. It's certainly not an ending position by any means, you know, and they're under no illusion, nor are we. But at least there can be cordial discussion and engagement. Absent that, we get nowhere. In terms of engagement with Muslims, it could be mentioned also that Luther actually wrote a preface for an addition to the Quran, that this thing would be published and printed. He wanted it read so that people would be informed and they could then understand what the Ottomans were about. Today, it's good for Christians to read this and to know what they're talking about when they engage Muslims, rather than converse out of ignorance, converse out of knowledge.
Thank you, Dr. Rosin. We'll take a break now. And when we come back, we'll talk to you about the man Luther and his personality. Don't go away. Stay tuned, because we will be right back.
If you like what you're listening to, then let your contacts know about Lutheran Radio UK. Use the Spread the Word function on our website, lutheranradio.co.uk, and tell your friends on Facebook and Twitter. Alternatively, you can write the emails of your contacts in the Tell a Friend field at the bottom of our main page, and we'll send them a personalized invitation to listen. Help us to proclaim the good news of Christ by telling others about Lutheran Radio UK. And don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter, and we will keep you right up to date about our programs.
Since 1962, Westfield House in Cambridge has been preparing students with the knowledge, attitudes, and skills necessary for the ministry of the Evangelical Lutheran Church and its proclamation of the gospel of Jesus Christ. As a centre of theological studies, it also seeks to serve the Lutheran Church, both in this country and overseas, by the promotion of Christian learning at all levels. Westfield House provides theological education within the framework of a confessional Lutheran perspective and offers resources that further the understanding of that perspective. Westfield House also offers the only significant Lutheran library in the country. Find out more about Westfield House on the internet at www.westfieldhouse.org.uk Westfield House, the Theological College of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of England.
You are listening to Lutheran Radio UK, all about Christ and to all God's people.
Welcome back. I'm Pastor Jamie Krieger, and you're listening to Radio Biography. We're talking to Dr. Robert Rosin from Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, Missouri, about the life and work of Martin Luther. Dr. Rosin, Luther was a man of the letter, but also a man of the people. He liked to drink. He swore a lot. He was quite unconventional to the standards of many in our day and age. Often a coarse man, and in the course of time, Luther was a priest who got married. Do these characteristics of his personality speak against him, especially to individuals in a more Puritan environment, or can we see his theology reflected in the man he was?
In terms of the swearing, yes, the vocabulary is sometimes shocking to us. We've got to remember, though, too, sometimes what some people consider to be off-color, other societies, other cultures in different times don't. It's that way even still today. We've lived in Germany for a number of years, and you simply find there's some words that are used in common parlance that we'd never say in our own culture. It just comes offhand. And they don't think anything of it. It's just not considered necessarily off color. That said, certainly Luther's language at times could be coarse and crude. Some of that, I think, is frankly being a Saxon, not just simply a German. The Saxons tend to have rather colorful language. Luther will talk about getting right down into the snout of people when he preaches, and people think, what kind of an image is that? But he means kind of going nose to nose, toe to toe, like we would sometimes say. In a different way. Yeah, he's coarse and crude, but that's the way he also winds up communicating to the people. When he writes the Bible, he wants to put it in their language with his biblical translations, not in a kind of proper antiseptic German, but a German rather that related to them. He listened to the common folk in the street, and then tried to kind of hit a median between a general German that all could read, that is to say, it isn't too idiosyncratic and dialect-oriented, but also one that still meant something to the people, that they heard God talking in their language, so to speak. When he preaches, he does the same sort of thing. It's hardly academic language that he uses, but he's not preaching to academics. He's preaching to the common folk. It's something that preachers have to learn today as well. You know, sometimes you find pastors who will sort of, we might say, put on airs, to put it properly. That is to say, they kind of strike a pose and almost as if it's a little bit of theater as they carry through. Well, on the one hand, a person wants to be respectful of worship and respectful of what's going on in Sunday morning with the liturgy, with our being there to sing praise to God, and then also, of course, to hear what he has done for us. That said, you still have to put things in people's language. If you use words that they simply don't understand, what's the point? I say, well, but it's the proper theological term. Proper to whom and proper to what? If it doesn't communicate, I've simply made the task of the Holy Spirit harder, getting in his way. You know, the Holy Spirit works through words, through communication, but if people don't understand what I'm saying, And Luther certainly wanted people to understand what he was saying, and so he was often very blunt and very colorful. As I said, part of it's just simply being 16th century, part of it's being Saxon, and part of it is trying to relate to the folk. We might not say it the same way, but at least we can kind of learn to appreciate it. And there are preachers today who are kind of parallels, you know, properly speaking, adjusted to their own culture and temperament. At least I hope they're preachers like that, someone who can simply sort of sit down and chew the fat, to use an idiom, with people, and get round finally then to the biblical message and talk to them and engage them in their own life. I have a shirt-tail relative who is a pastor in Germany, who was at a parish that had multiple pastors. There were some who would preach going through the professional motion on Sunday morning. And frankly, there weren't very many people there. And then my relative, when he preached, would have a full congregation. Why? Because he spent the week before going around town, meeting the people and finding out what they were like. He went into the bakery and talked to the baker, into the butcher shop and shot the breeze with the butcher for a little bit. How's his day going? What's his life like? He knew what their problems were. He knew what their hopes were, and he could engage them on Sunday morning. He could not simply sort of preach antiseptically a kind of general to whom it may concern sermon, but he really did preach for the people that were there in his parish. It's exactly what Luther did. He understood the Germans there in Wittenberg. He sometimes called them my pagans, you know, because they lived in often rather wretched lives, and he could scold them and he could pile it on. At the same time, he would turn right around and comfort them with the gospel, just enfold them in the soft arms of the cross, trying to show them that Christ's love was indeed unique and was special. It was personal. Luther at one point says that he likes to think of God's love being so deep that if the entire world had somehow escaped sin and he alone were the only sinner, God would have done everything he did just for him. It's that kind of personal engagement and personal touch that Luther sought after. And that means talking people's language. We may not use quite the same idioms and the vocables that he did, of course, but the approach, the attitude, the intent is really still the same. Yeah, he lives in a colorful world and lived a very colorful life.
When we speak of Luther, we often hear of him involved in a controversy against the Pope, Zwingli, Karlstadt, Bucer, the Eckland parties, John Tattles, and even Erasmus. Then there's the issue of the Peasants' War, which we spoke about before. Is there a nice side to Luther, or is he just a cantankerous fellow?
Sure, there's a nice side to Luther as well. Let's first say, as far as all these controversies go, I mean, Luther understood this. This is simply goes with the territory. He said once he simply calls an apple, and a pear, that is to say, we might say today, a spade, a spade. He said that's how it is when someone builds on the highway, that is, when he writes for the public. He understood that he didn't go looking for any of this, but was thrust into the public eye. Luther would say God is using him to help revive the gospel in the church, and when that happens, there's going to come naturally opposition. There are going to be people who, on a human level, feel threatened, people who don't like what's going on, and they're going to oppose him. And Luther also saw a kind of giant cosmic war between God and Satan, God and the devil. The devil is going to try to seek however he can to raise up opposition. So Luther saw this as simply kind of vindication. Not that he goes looking for trouble. You don't lead with your chin, so to speak. You don't have to. It's going to come soon enough. He talked about his day wars with the people around him. He talked about his night wars with himself, where he would go back to his study at the end of the day and he would say, have I done the right thing? Should I have said this? Maybe I should have been stronger there, or I should have been softer there. You sort of second-guess yourself. But the worst war or the worst trial for Luther was no trial at all, because then suddenly when everything is going swimmingly, you stop and you think, gee, maybe I've gone down the wrong path. And the devil thinks, let sleeping dogs lie. Just let him go right on the way it is, and he's not helping the cause of the gospel here. So Luther talked about day and night struggles and then, of course, the ultimate struggle of there being no struggle at all. A lot of that causes him to necessarily be confrontational and pugnacious. He didn't particularly care for it, but you kind of have to do it. And as I said earlier, it was a harsh age. People hurled epithets back and forth at each other, called each other names. There are no libel laws. You might complain to the other person's prince and say that he's being unfair in his characterization of me, but you're probably not going to get a very sympathetic ear because the prince probably knows what's going on and would endorse what had been written by his theologian, regardless of which side of a controversy it's on. At the same time, Luther certainly enjoyed life and had great fun with life. He loved music. He was somewhat of an accomplished musician, had a tenor voice, and then he also was a good lute player, and he enjoyed music at home. It was a way of relaxing personally, and then, of course, once he's married. he's got a family side. Luther in the family shows all the kind of emotions we see on the professional as well. He had a temper. He knew that was his special sin, not that he's proud of it. He means that was something he had to particularly watch out for, that he would lose his temper. At the same time, he could be a soft touch. He said that no child of his would ever get anything from him by uncontrolled weeping or sniveling. I mean, he's a kind of German of his age, a German male. At the same time, he could be a soft touch for a good story. He was generous to a fault, always giving things away. His wife, Katie, whom he married in 1525, she'd been a nun, left the cloister when the Reformation was happening with another group of nuns, who left, slipped out by night. All of them were kind of resettled, found new professions, found husbands, except for Catherine von Bora, who told Luther that she didn't appreciate any of the matchmaking efforts he was going through. She would settle for him and him alone. He found that both amusing and disturbing. Amusing because it was sort of cute, and on the other hand, disturbing because here's a man who's already 42 years old to get married at that point with a price on his head, you know, being a heretic and an outlaw within the empire. What kind of a stable home life can that bring? But they got married. He did that in part, as he said, to please his father and despite the Pope, because his father, who always wanted him to have heirs in the first place, now finally might get a family from it. The name might be carried on. And they did. They had six children. One girl died in infancy, and Magdalene, his daughter, died short of her 14th birthday. That was very painful for him. Personally, there were three boys, three girls, in a home that was filled with far more than those people, because the Luther household also took in student boarders. When they were married, the Prince Frederick gave Luther the use of the Black Cloister, the Augustinian Cloister, which now wasn't holding monks anymore. So Luther and Katie moved into several of those rooms. He actually lectured in a large room within the cloister. He simply went out one door, walked across about a four-foot hallway and into the door of his lecture room next door. So he has no excuse for being late for class. And in that household, Katie managed very well, because Luther was really, as I said, generous to a fault. She watched out for the little piece of family property that they bought, a little farm. He called her the Countess of Zoltzdorf. This is the place where the family farm was. She managed the budget with all these mouths to feed in the house, and she kept Luther from giving everything away. There's a story of Luther writing a congratulatory letter to a friend of his who's also gotten married, and he's determined that he's going to give him as a wedding present a vase that Luther himself had received, a rather nice piece of artwork. And Luther writes and then says suddenly in the letter, I'll have to send it to you later. Katie's hidden it, because she knew that he'd just simply give things like this away. Generous to a fault. You mentioned a moment ago the confrontations Luther had with people such as Karlstadt. Karlstadt was a senior professor at Wittenberg. He, however, went off in a kind of radical Reformation direction, a kind of almost fundamentalist reading of the New Testament. Let no man call you master, Jesus said. And so Karlstadt said, oh, that means no academic degrees. And he renounced his master's degree and his doctor's degree. He wanted to celebrate Lord's Supper in street clothes, handing things out to people, because he thought this would show his disdain for the papacy. Many of the things that Karlstadt sometimes suggested, Luther later got around to, but it was too much too fast, crammed down the people's throats before they'd been educated to really understand the changes that might come. Karlstadt, after some 1521-22 uprisings in Wittenberg, was driven out of town because he was the cause of some of this unrest. And so he disappeared with his family. He tried to find other places to go and to serve. And he kind of went from pillar to post, never quite settling down. And he finally shows up back in Wittenberg in 1525 when Luther's getting married to Katie, knocks on the door of the cloister, and Luther, generous to a fault, took them in. Here was a man with whom he disagreed profoundly, theologically, on one level, and yet on another level, he took him in and sheltered him in his home until Karstadt found another place to go with his family. I mean, that's the kind of a person Luther is. He could segment things enough to understand how you could disagree and yet show Christian love.
Thank you, Dr. Rosin. We will come back with you next week when we hope you will talk to us about the pastor, Martin Luther, and the theology of the cross.
Come back next week at this same time on Lutherman Radio UK as we continue with Radio Biography and our series with Dr. Robert Rosin on the life and work of Martin Luther. I would like to hear your impressions and suggestions on this program, as well as Lutheran Radio UK's entire range of shows. Send an email to me, Pastor Jamie Krieger, to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this series is available for download from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Lutheran Radio UK is the radio station of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of England. For information about our congregations, go to lutheran.co.uk and click on directory. I hope and pray that by our broadcast, you'd be encouraged to learn more about the Lutheran exposition of the Holy Scriptures, which Martin Luther was ready to die for, uncompromisingly saying, "Here I stand, I can do no other." I would like to invite you to visit the nearest Lutheran congregation to you and partake with your family in our worship services, Bible studies, and Sunday schools. Check our program online and stay tuned for our next programs. God's blessings to you, and goodbye for now.